G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Treasures from the Tanakh on Truth to You. That's truth number two, letter U.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Torah teacher Ira Michelson. G'day, mate.
G'day, Jono. How are you?
Very well, thank you, my friend, and good to have you back, because we're in, what are we, Job 27?
27, we are, yeah.
Chapter 27, and it begins like this. It begins saying that, moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, and of course the previous chapter, Ira, was Job chatting away, although there was some disagreement in my NJPS about that. They figured that 25 was Job and that 26 was Bildad. We got over that hurdle, and here it confirms once even more so that Job continued. There's a suggestion in my in the notes of my New King James that perhaps Job had paused and perhaps even looked at Zophar and said, "You want to weigh in here at all? You got anything to say? This is your turn. The limelight could switch over to you. You got something to say? Say it now. No? Nothing? Nothing? Going? Gone? Bang!" And then he's back into it. Yeah. Zophar had nothing to say.
Yeah. Well, I think I think it's important that we notice what the word there is. In verse 1 where it says Mishalo, because it comes from Mishal, like a proverb. And we see this in the next four or so chapters from 27 to 31 before we see Elihu come on the stage. Mm-hmm. And so for me, these next four chapters are kind of broken down into what I call two Mishalim, where they're parables or themes. And it kind of seems like a continuation, but there's kind of a change, because for me, what I see is the debate with his friends is over, and now he kind of reflects on some of the things that have been said, on his past, on his present, on his future, and of course, I don't want to get into Elihu just now, because we're going to get to him at some point
and talk about it.
But it almost appears that that these next two Mishalim are kind of reworking of previous statements that have been made. And we got to try and figure out whose benefit this is for. Like, in other words, is Job saying these things for his own benefit? Mm-hmm. Or could it be for the benefit of the people who are intently listening? And that's why I bring up Elihu, because, you know, when we do see Elihu, he doesn't appear to be somebody. I think he even identifies that he's not an elder like the other friends are.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of been in the background. And we've talked about the fact that at this point there has to have been a large crowd that gathered to see what's going on here, and probably a lot of people were intently listening to this courtroom drama that we were talking about. And so what I see is an interesting distinction that Job makes in this Mishal, in what we call in the Hebrew Timimim and the Chonef. And Timimim comes from that idea of that same word that we see introduced in the very first chapter, in the very first verse, where Job is referred to as Ish Tam, a righteous man or a blameless man. That word Tam is the same where we get Timimim, which could be referencing people who are people of integrity, versus the Chonef, which is the person that we see often called the godless person. And sometimes it's not just a godless person, but it could mean a person who receives unwarranted profit from certain things. You know, like the person that does nothing, kind of like the wicked person that becomes wealthy on the backs of other people, which is one of the things that Job has been accused of in the past by some of his friends. And so we see this distinction. We're going to get into this. We're going to see this distinction when we look at verse 5 as opposed to verse 8 in this present chapter. But we see this use of chonef, or one of the different conjugations of it, where his friends have hurled this idea of the chonef at him at one time or another. Bildad uses it in chapter 8, verse 13. Eliphaz uses it in chapter 15, verse 34. Zophar uses it in chapter 20, verse 5. And Job uses it to hurl back at them. Job hurls it back at Zophar in chapter 13, verse 16. And Eliphaz in 1638, and then it kind of would seem in general here that he's using it, although it could be considered as an answer to Bildad, since Bildad was the last one to speak. And as I said, we get that concept from chapter 1:1. And so I think that we can understand why Job would be dealing with this now in light of the debate up to this point, because the friends his friends, this is for me, I'm going to sum up what we've done so far in the first 26 chapters in these debates that went back and forth, which I believe have now ended because we're not going to hear from them anymore. We're only going to hear from Elihu, and then we get towards the end as we move forward. The friends seem to find no bridge between the Job that they knew, the Job that was called an Ishtam, the Job that they saw as a pious man who was one of their own, and the person who's sitting before them now, this bitter, unyielding, and sarcastic wretch of a man. And there's only one answer for them, and that would be, with everything they've said, is that he would have to be a chonef. He would have to, his original piety was a sham. That a hypocrite who's only faithful as long as things are profitable for him. Did you ever know any people like that? Because I certainly have.
Sure.
In my past, and I'm sure you did in your past.
Certainly, and yet, Ira, you mentioned the three words you use, which I think are excellent. I just want to repeat them: bitter, unyielding, and sarcastic. And I would have to agree that is who we are dealing with, in particularly in this chapter. We're dealing with Job as a bitter person, as an unyielding person, and as a sarcastic person. But at the same time, I think we're going to establish that it's fair that he is such, and that it doesn't detract from him, from his character.
Absolutely, and I think this is why the concept of the chonef is so important, because we've seen it so many times in every argument that they've brought, and we've seen him answer back, because in the second part, of these Meshalim, which is contained within these, with the two chapters of chapter 27 and 28, we see Job dealing with his friends, what he considers a very indefensible position.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally after he deals with those kind of things, then he deals with the subject of wisdom. And so you're absolutely right. You know, on the surface, you would think that he's a bitter, unyielding, and sarcastic person. But I think what he's doing now is he's saying, okay, guys, you've had your say. I've heard everything that you have to say. And he's answered kind of in the past, but now he's going to rework the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And he's going to set the whole thing up and say, you guys think you know God. Let me tell you what God's really like.
And that's pretty much what he does say. We will get to that. But it starts, of course, verse 1. Verse 2 says, as God lives, who has taken away my justice. Here's a couple of accusations, Ira. Who has taken away my justice. And the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, so he's admitting to being bitter. And that's verse 2, and I think they're fair. I don't know that there are accusations as such as just stating the facts. How do you interpret that?
Well, it's clear that he says that, but the important words that we see at the beginning is the idea that he says, "As God lives," and that's significant that it starts off that way, because it's almost. It's almost can be taken as him swearing in the name of God.
Hmm.
And so for me, because he introduces it as God lives first, what he's doing is he's introducing the fact for me that he still loves God, that he still puts God first, and that, yes, I still believe that God has put aside my judgment, that he's depriving me of justice, and yes, the Almighty is the one who caused my soul to be bitter, but as God lives. And the reason I say that is because no man could swear on the life of God that did not love God. Nobody would be stupid enough to do that, especially not somebody who already we know was said directly from the mouth of God. He's ish tam v'yashal. He's blameless and upright.
Absolutely. So I totally agree with you there. I totally agree. And it goes on to say, as long as my breath is in me and the breath of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me, he says, Ira, far be it from me that I should say you are right, he says to his friends. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me, my righteousness. I hold fast and will not let go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live.
Yeah.
And there's the unyieldingness, right?
There's that, definitely that unyieldingness. And so what I always like to bring this up, because I think it's it may not be necessarily fully relevant to the subject at hand, what we're discussing in Job, but I always love that idea of talking about this concept of the breath of God. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting, because it says, "Ki chol od nishmati Ruach Eloha Ba'api, you know, this idea of the breath of God. And this is really the thing that separates us from the rest of creation.
Mm-hmm.
This is the very thing that separates us from the animalistic world and the animalistic nature that, that exists within us. When you read about the creation, we know that every created thing, whether it's animal or man, has a nefesh. It has a soul. And we see usually that word nefesh is always the word that we see in Hebrew for soul. Mm-hmm. My dog has a nefesh. He gets thirsty. He gets hungry. He needs sleep just like the rest of us. But there's a difference when God creates man. And what it says is that God gives man the nishmat chayim. He gives them the soul of life or the breath of life.
Mm-hmm.
He breathed into Adam, okay, this life. And so I think that's significant in what Job is speaking of as well, in certainly the idea that he again, is recognizing not only love for God, but recognizing that it's God who breathed a life into man, that breathed life into him. And this is why he begins this this dissertation, this mashal, to kind of subtly, he goes into it in a less tactful way, in some verses coming up, but at least here he's subtly trying to show them that, let me tell you what God is really like.
Mm.
He wants it known through this debate that he has not uttered any falsehood or deceit, in verse 4. I think that's what he's saying. And I think when he says, far be it from me that I should justify you till I die, or up to my death, I will not turn aside my integrity from me.
Mm.
He's basically telling them, I will never agree to your premise that I am not what God proclaimed me to be at the beginning.
Amen.
Which is Ishtam.
A man of
God
incredible.
Said it, I am.
Incredible integrity that Job is. And so he continues, verse 7, may my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite, though he may gain much? If God takes away his life, will God hear his cry when trouble comes upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call on God?
Yeah, so he gets a little bit less tactful when he starts using the term hypocrite here.
We've got enemy, we've got wicked, we've got hypocrite.
Yeah, yeah, and these are the same kind of things that have been hurled at him before. But I just want to go back because I didn't touch on verse 6, and I think there's something interesting there.
Sure.
that I found may be of interest to the listeners as well. And that's kind of a rabbinic slant on the Hebrew that we see here, because in chapter 27, verse 6, we see the word heart.
Mm-hmm.
Which is usually where it would be my heart, we would see the word libi or livi, not livavi, which is what we see here. We kind of see the double bet there describing this. And one of the commentators I thought was interesting talked about this, because this only appears in one other verse that I know of, and the other place is chapter 17, verse 11.
Uh-huh.
Every other time it's spelled differently. And what the sages teach is that this is speaking of somebody that's two-hearted, or kind of could be considered like double-minded, and it makes sense in the fact that Job most certainly, like most of us in our suffering, have had struggles and thinking to ourselves, I just wish this would be over,
mm-hmm.
And I think that there had to be times where maybe Job thought, if I just admit guilt, this whole thing would be over. And yet, at the same time, those typically with us, and surely with Job, those are just fleeting thoughts. If we mm-hmm. really have a connection with God, they just become fleeting thoughts, and we recognize, that wouldn't be, that certainly wouldn't be, integrity to do that. So I just thought that was an interesting take from a rabbinic
perspective
that they bring that. It's hard to believe, going forward, when he starts talking, using words like enemy and the wicked and hypocrite, like we said, it's hard to believe that Joe is not answering his friends here.
Oh, he has to. Surely that's what he's
right. doing. And of course, with quite a smack in the face as well, because he's basically saying, in these next few verses, those who want to claim that I'm wicked, as I am maintaining my integrity, may they share in the fate of the wicked.
Mm-hmm.
But we see something that is possibly even more revelational in the Hebrew for me, and that's that the word for enemy there is in the singular.
Really?
It doesn't say my enemies, it says my enemy. And the word for enemy, like I said, is singular, so it could relate to Eliphaz, who in chapter 22 accused Job of every type of wickedness, if we remember mm-hmm. back that far.
Mm-hmm.
You remember he kind of went through a whole laundry list of things that, you know, he claimed that he took pledges from the poor, you know, for no reason. He withheld water from the thirsty. You know, if you remember back in 22, that's when Eliphaz accused Job of.
He didn't hold back at all, no.
Yeah, so it's possible. We don't know. It's possible. So it's one possibility, only because it's in singular. But it could just be he's talking to the friends as one single unit. But I just thought that was interesting that mm-hmm. it's in singular. So it could very well be that it's because in certain verses, I think he is pointing out particular people. They came sure. at him with particular types of arguments.
Mm-hmm.
We also see in verse 8, this is where we kind of passed it over in verse 5, but the Hebrew for that word integrity comes from that same root of tam. I think it's in verse 5, it's the Hebrew is tumati
mm-hmm.
In verse 5. And then here we have that other word introduced that I talked about, chonef, but here it's chanef in verse 8. What is the hope of the godless when he is cut off, when God takes away his soul? And the other word that we see there in verse 8.
So you've got, what is the hope of the godless? So I've got, what is the hope of the hypocrite? You've got godless.
Right, and that's why I'm saying it could be translated in many different ways. It could be hypocrite, it could be godless. It talks about that person that I said kind of because it comes from a root. That's the word that I'm looking for here in where it says ki ma tikvat chanev ki yivtsa. Mm-hmm. That word yivtsa there comes from a root of that can mean dishonest prophet. I'm sorry, chanev comes from that root that can also mean a dishonest prophet. So it could mean hypocrite. It could be somebody who, you know, who profits dishonestly. It's always talking about the impious person,
mm-hmm.
a person without piety.
Sure.
Okay. Which certainly could be a hypocrite. And it's talking about that person, and we'll develop this further as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
Because it could be a reference to from previous verses that even stealing someone's reputation. He could be getting at that here too. That basically his reputation has been stolen by these people, and he's kind of throwing it back at them. That all through this, you've been talking to me as if I'm the chonef, and yet you're the ones who have stolen my reputation.
That, I mean, you're quite right. And he doesn't mix his words here. He's like, I'm over it. I'm just going to tell it like it is because I'm just over. And he says in 11, I will teach you. I mean, there's no mixing of words. He's very sure of himself here. I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Surely, he's absolutely sure of himself. And, you know, before where he might have been a little bit more subtle, here he's very, very blunt. I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense, is what he says.
Sure. And what we're going to see in the rest of the chapter now is what I call these doubles. We see two verses. Sometimes they're referred to as doublets. And what he starts to do is he starts to develop what the chonef, what the traits of the chonef really are.
We've established those three words that his unyieldingness, mm-hmm. his bitterness. Now are we about to see the sarcasm from verse 13 to 23?
Oh, absolutely, we're going to see it. But what he does is he brings the sarcasm in these doublets, bringing out the different traits of this person who's the chonef, who's the real chonef,
mm-hmm.
which he has been accused of, and he brings it in a different way. First, he brings it in what the chonef is like in his relationship with God, which we see mm-hmm. in the next couple of verses. Then he deals with the chonef in this idea of his desire to outlive his death through his children. Then we see the traits of the chonef as it relates to his wealth. Then as it relates to his home and his possessions. then as it relates to the natural forces, and then some believe it's community. But we're going to see something really interesting in the last two verses. Because the last two verses, for me, I see completely different than most of the translations that I see out there.
Really? Okay, I'll look forward to getting that.
I think it's So when we go forward in this first double that we see in verse 9 and 10, what does he say? He says, will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? And this is the first of those doubles. It actually, one of the translations I read says, will God hear his screams?
Really?
So it's if he is speaking to his friends here, which of course you and I believe he is, he's basically telling them that if you are in fact acting like the Chonef, thinking that you have taken up God's cause for him, because remember, we've seen that, you know, where some of these guys think that they're speaking on behalf of God, you're going to be sadly mistaken when you cry out to him and he doesn't answer. What do you have for verse 10? I'm interested to see what your translation
Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call on God?
Sure. Actually, that word that you have for delight actually means to refresh himself or to pamper himself. Upon the Almighty, will he refresh himself calling God at all times? In other words, does the chonef, this person that's impious, that's a hypocrite, that, you know, that goes after dishonest profit, can he live a life of luxury and then call out to God whenever he pleases? And you know what? This was me. I lived that life. I had a very successful business many, many years ago, and I squandered that business away through wrong living. This was before I had a relationship, you know, came back into relationship with God. And I did very well. I had an office in a building in one of the top buildings in Miami, in the business district, right on the water. My office overlooked the water, and I remember being this chonef. Why do I say that? Because when everything fell apart and everything was when nothing was left, and I walked into my office one day and all that was left was my desk and my chair. Because they had come in and taken everything out. I sat down, Jonah, at that desk, in my chair, put my head down, and I started weeping. And then after I stopped weeping, I asked God why he was doing this to me.
Why he was doing it. You know why? He's not acting like the magic genie that we expect him to be like. You know, particularly in the tradition that I was brought up in, he was my magic genie. And when he didn't make everything good, you know, what's going on?
Yeah, but I wasn't even into the whole magic genie there. And the point is, what I'm trying to say is that I wasn't a good person, that I was going out there and I was drinking and I was doing drugs and I was cheating and stealing and business and, you know, doing all kinds of crazy things to step over people and to become successful because I just wanted to make the money and be successful and have people look at me. It wasn't unusual for me to, you know, to go into a nightclub and spend thousands of dollars on champagne, you know, in a night you know, I remember one time a close friend of mine came with me and ordered a bottle of champagne to be brought over, and he couldn't afford what I could afford. And I embarrassed him in front of everybody. You know, I said, "Oh, take that junk out of here and bring me a good bottle of champagne." You know, this is the kind of person I was. This is the life that I led. And I had the nerve to say that. And I have to tell you, I can never say that I ever heard an audible voice from God. But, you know, that inner voice that, you know, that many of us have claimed to have heard, I know that I heard it in my inner being God say to me, because you're not a very nice person, Ira.
Why have you done this to me? Because you're not a very nice person.
Because you're not a very nice person. And you know what? I did. I deserved it. And when he said that, everything flooded back to me that I knew about. I mean, I had never turned my back on God. It wasn't like that I didn't believe in God. I just didn't think, you know, it's like this discussion that we see going back and forth. Is God really concerned? Are we really concerned about the providence of God? Why do we see the wicked prosper and so forth? These are arguments that we see back and forth. And so I didn't think that God was so concerned with what I was doing. But when I cried out to him as a chonef, as an impious person, even though I didn't think I was doing anything wrong, he said, because you're not a nice person. And when he said it, I knew it. And I stopped crying and I picked myself up and I said to myself, Ira, you did this to yourself and you know, you got to suffer the consequences now. And this is what he's You know, this is what he's basically saying to his friends now. Don't think that you have that you've cornered the market on who God is and what you think you understand about God.
Mm. And hence verse 11 and 12, and that he will tell them about God, and that they're behaving with complete nonsense. Now, from 13 on, is it a sarcastic repetition of their words, as if to say, why then do you behave with complete nonsense, as in, and then launches into what appears to be points that they have made? Is that what we're dealing with here?
Absolutely. Okay. Because he's basically telling them that everything that you've said, it's basically kind of okay, guys, the shoe's on the other foot now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you've already had to say, you've had your say about how the Almighty runs things in the world. Let me tell you how it really is now.
So he says in 13, this is the portion of a wicked man with God and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread.
Yeah, and so if you look at Job chapter 20, verse 29, mm-hmm. This verse in 13 is almost word for word of what Zophar says at the end of his discussion on the wicked in chapter 20, when he calls Job, you know, this wicked guy. It starts off almost exactly the same. Actually, I think the first three or four words.
Yeah, he says this is the portion from God for a wicked man, a heritage appointed to him by God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So we see that almost word for word. So we know that this is definitely, you know, him repeating, let's talk about the nonsense. You called me wicked, and this is, you know, what you're talking about. You've already said, now let me tell you what the portion is.
Mm.
What does he go into? He goes into this idea of, you know, if his sons are many, it is for the sword, and his descendants shall not be satisfied with their bread. We could have one or two things going on here. We could have Job referring to his own children, warning them, because if he's relating this back to them, that, hey, what you've accused me of is what you really are. You guys better be careful, because you could just as easily suffer the same fate that I have,
potentially,
as a man of integrity. And then, of course, in the second, you know, the second perspective is that he's just talking about the fact that, you know, the wicked person is warned that he cannot live on through his children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it goes on to say in 15, those who survive him shall be buried in death, and their widows shall not weep.
And it is almana, because even you know, it's interesting when we were putting all our papers together for, you know, you see that, but that's still used. It's actually pretty close to an Aramaic, because you'll see that, when we had to do our Aliyah papers, we got some of the kitubot that we had to supply. We had, Lori's grandmother, and Lori's grandmother's first husband died very young. He was like 26 or 27 when he died.
Mm-hmm.
He had Lou Gehrig's disease. So when she got remarried, she was on the ketubah. It listed her as an almana, as a widow. So it definitely is widow, and it's his widow, but it's a plural construct. So
okay, so they can do that to the text. And their widows shall not weep, though he heaps up silver like dust, and piles up clothing like clay. He may pile it up, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just want to say one thing about the idea also in that verse about the that those who survive him shall be buried mm-hmm. in death. Because I just want to say that he's basically, if we look at the whole debate that's been going on, he's kind of saying that even if he were to admit that his friends were right, that the children would eventually suffer, it would mean nothing, because when you look at the traits of the Chonef, he doesn't mm-hmm. care about what happens when he dies. Like, he doesn't care that, mm-hmm. you know, because it's all about his wealth. It's all about what we're seeing in these next couple of verses. That, you know, for him, it's about wealth, that he heaps up silver like dust and like clay. There's attire. Yeah, here we have, and here we have that next double about the relationship to wealth that I talked about. He may prepare it, but the righteous will wear it, and the silver the innocent will divide. And I think it's interesting, some of the some commentators actually think that the he here is talking about God. I don't really see that, but
Really, that's interesting. No, I didn't pick that up.
Yeah, I know, but some commentators that I've read have, you know, refer this to God, that God
made that connection.
Prepare it. Yeah.
So the he continues. It says he builds his house like a moth. That's kind of weird. He builds his house like a moth.
Well,
how does a moth build a house? All I know is that moths eat clothes.
Yeah. So I think this is kind of a reference in the same way to that we saw like in previous chapters about the spider. You know how fragile the house is that the wicked person builds.
Mm-hmm, okay. He builds his house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman makes. The rich man shall lie down, but not be gathered up. Ira, he won't be raptured. And he opens his eyes, and he is no more. What is that, but not be gathered up?
What do you mean, and not be gathered up?
That's what I've got in 19. The rich man will lie down, but not be gathered up.
Yeah, I know. That's what you said, and that's why I chuckled when you said that and said something about the rapture. You're such a troublemaker, Dono.
Come on. I mean, he's a rich man. He's a bad. He's naughty.
That's not what it says, though.
Come on. It says gathered up. That must be
what it's talking about. What is that? Is that the new King James?
That's the new King James. What it says in the...
Does it have an asterisk taking you to First Thessalonians or something?
It actually does have an asterisk, you know?
It does.
You know what? It does... It doesn't take me to the New Testament at all. Instead, it has, what does it say? It says, following the Masoretic text, and Targum, Septuagint, Syriac, read, but shall not add. Do it again. The Vulgate reads, but take away nothing. Now, in my NJPS, verse 19 says, he lies down, a rich man, with, and in brackets, his wealth intact. Mm-hmm. So his wealth is in brackets, so I'm assuming that means that's not there. But he lies down a rich man intact, I suppose, is what it's saying.
Right. So the Hebrew word that we're looking at in verse 19 is the Hebrew word yasif, mm-hmm. yasif. And this relates to harvest, believe it or not.
Okay, so harvest, gathering up. Okay, so there's the connection.
That's the point. So, right, but it's not the idea of him not being gathered. It really has the idea of that he lies down and he gathers nothing, like he harvests nothing, and he opens his eyes and there's nothing. So it kind of has this connotation of that the rich may lie down rich, like he may go to his sick bed, for instance. Mm-hmm. But eventually, because he doesn't have the ability to gather, he loses everything. And rather than opening his eyes to a brand new day, instead, he opens his eyes to nothing. He'll be dead. There won't even be money to bury him with.
Mm-hmm. All right. That makes sense. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. A tempest.
Wait a minute. He just got raptured.
He's been raptured. And now, no, it says he will not be raptured.
Oh, what do you mean? It just says he makes off with him at night.
So it does.
The steals makes off with him at night.
He does get raptured after all. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. There you go. Either he is or he's not. Anyway, the east wind carries him away. Oh, he's definitely raptured, Ira. Come on. The east wind carries him away, and he's gone. It sweeps him out of his place. Oh, hang on. No, it doesn't. Hang on. Wait a minute. 22. It hurls against him.
No. Yeah. Okay.
And does not spare.
Let's not go so far.
Okay, I don't think he's raptured. That's not a good rapture.
Oh, he's not? Okay. It's not a good rapture?
No,
I didn't say it was a good rapture.
Picks him up and throws him down, I think.
Yeah. Terrors overtake him like waters or like a flood, like you said, and a tempest steals or makes off with him at night. And this is the double that I spoke about relating to the natural forces. And so this could also be considered a continuation of the last verse in that he opens his eyes to terror and confusion because he was snatched away by mm-hmm. the whirlwind.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, in Job 18:14, we see, you know, kind of this similar kind of wording where it says, he's torn from the safety of his tent. Why am I bringing that up? Because in the Hebrew of verse 20, we see, Tasigehu chamayim balachot. And why I'm bringing 14 up, and this is where it gets really interesting. Let me put on my interesting voice now. It says in verse 14, I'm going to read the Hebrew, you read the English.
Okay, so if his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread.
No, not verse 14 in this, 18, oh. Job 18:14.
Oh, 18,
the reason 14. Why I brought it is because it says the third word that I read to you in verse 20, where I said, Tasigehu chamayim balachot, we see in chapter 18, verse 14, it says, Yinatek me ehalo miftacho v'tatsi dehu lemelech balahot. What does it say for you?
I'm going to read from 11. It says, terrors frighten him on every side and drive him to his feet. His strength is starved. His destruction is ready at his side. It devours patches on his skin. The firstborn of death devours his limbs. He is uprooted from the shelter of his tents, and they parade him before the King of Terrors.
Ooh, the King of Terrors.
Do you know what? I don't even have King of Terrors in capitals. That's another opportunity missed.
I'm telling you, that's why I had to bring it. The King of Terrors. He's marched before the King of Terrors. So this is who raptures him. He's raptured by the King of Terrors. No. So we see that same.
I've got in the study note here, the King of Terrors, probably death personified as a king. Others suggest that this may refer to capital S Satan.
Capital S Satan. So really this is a comparison that the way this verse describes and the next verse describes these powers in the natural, like a whirlwind or a tempest. Why I brought that idea of the, you know, Balahot is that, and this idea of the King of Terrors, to kind of, what I wanted to do was dispel the whole capital S Satan thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And remember, we talked about Shadim last week or the week before. We talked about, you pronounced it Shades, you know, or Shadim, and we talked about them, you know, that sometimes they're called demons or whatever. But the Shadim that we discussed were the malevolent departed spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so this is one of the possibilities that this is talking about when it says balahot, this idea of terrors and being snatched away, that he's kind of snatched away towards the, you know, towards the dead, in the same way that we see the King of Terrors here in 18:14, that this is, you know, this is the kind of tempest and the whirlwind that he's snatched away by these shebin, the balahot.
Hmm. Well, then now that takes us back, of course, what you're referring to is Job 26. Five, I think, where it says the dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol is naked before him, and destruction has no covering, and so on and so forth. And it is interesting that here we're talking about terrors overtake him like a flood, a tempest steals him away in the nights, and so on and so forth.
Sure. So that's one possibility. You know, the reason why I did that is because typically what people want to do is, they want to read something like that, like King of Terrors, or they want to read these kind of things have snatched away. They might see a commentary, like you just said, or they'll see a commentary that might relate to the demonic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to dispel that from a Hebrew perspective, what, you know, mm-hmm. what he says and what the Jewish perspective would be on something like that.
Very good. Okay.
So, but here we get into that really interesting thing that I talked about in verse 22 and 23, because what does it say for you?
22 and 23, it hurls against him. This is the east wind that carries him away, and he is gone. It sweeps him up out of his place. There's his rapture. But that's not nice to him, Ira. It says it hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clasp their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place.
Do you think that's what it says?
I'm just saying this, what it's written there. Now that you've mentioned it,
But you know a little bit of Hebrew, Jonah.
I'm not looking at the Hebrew. I'm looking at the New King James. I'm just going to go to my NJPS in 22 and 23, and it says, then it hurls itself at him without mercy. He tries to escape from its force. It claps its hands at him and whistles at him from its place. It's kind of similar. What do you got?
Well, I'm asking you. So if you look at do you have Hebrew in front of you?
I can. Hang on a second.
You know?
See, now not only is it in a different order, but it's all backwards.
What do you mean?
But now I've got the Hebrew Bible.
Oh, it's backwards.
Hang on. 27, 22, and 23. No, okay, so I've got it in front of me. Walk me through it.
Okay, so what do we see? We see Vayishlech and Yishpok. Yishpok, right? We see both of those. What does that Yud tell us? In those verbs.
It's possessive, is that right?
It is. And usually it's going to be what? Third person. He.
He. Okay. So did I have he in English?
No.
It.
It.
Ah. Okay.
It.
Interesting.
And so here's the thing for me. I don't believe those translations. I don't think that when we see suddenly, you could make the argument that because it's talking about a tempest and because it's talking about an east wind and everything else, that this is related to those. But I could just as easily see these last two verses being referred to God, because he has at the beginning set up this whole concept of, you've said what God is about, let me tell you what God is really like. Now, this is what he does to the Choneth. This is what he does to the impious person. And so it could just as easily for me read, and he hurls upon him without mercy. From his hand, he would surely flee. He claps his hands at him and hisses at him from his place.
Okay. No, I can see that.
So I'm just saying that's another perspective. We could make the argument both ways from the Hebrew here.
In either case, it's a negative experience for the poor chap. There's no escape, but it's interesting the point that you make. I can see that.
Yeah, and not only can we see it, but the point is, who would be the one that would bring the tempest? Who would be the one that would bring the whirlwind? That would bring the east wind? That would be the one that would be causing him to be snatched away? Of course, it's God. So, you know, to make that argument is not a stretch.
Sure.
And so here we are, Job ends the first part of this Mashal, and, you know, he'll continue in chapter 28, mm-hmm. in which he describes to these men what will befall those who really act like the Choneth. And we know that this is connected to the next chapter, because the first word we see in the next chapter is the Hebrew word ki, which is usually that or because or for, but it's in here it's because, mm-hmm. and, you know, it continues it. And then what we see is where Job now begins to expound on wisdom.
That's what I have in my little subheading in the New King James. It says Job's discourse on wisdom, and that's chapter 80. That's chapter 28. That's the chapter we're going to be doing next week.
Yeah, because now he goes into this idea of, now I'm going to expound on wisdom, the same way that I expounded on God against your folly. Now I'm going to expound on wisdom, not the folly that he believes his friends have shared, but in the true wisdom that comes with Yirat Hashem, mm-hmm. the fear of God.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Ira Michelson, my friend, thank you for coming back onto Truth to You. Treasures from the Tanakh is the Facebook page, as well as Torah Threads. Torah Threads. There is also a Facebook page and the website, of course, torahthreads.com. Is that correct?
It is correct.
TorahThreads.com. And so thank you, my friend, for coming back on the program. Chapter 28 of Job is where we are up to next week. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom.